I want you to take a second and just think about the smartwatch on your wrist right now.
Oh.
You know, assuming you're wearing one.
Right. Or even just your phone.
Yeah, exactly. Or like consider the anti-lock brakes in your car, even something as basic as your washing machine at home.
Oh, yeah. People completely underestimate household appliances.
They really do. Because when that washing machine knows the exact like microsecond to stop spinning so your clothes don't get totally ruined, or when those brakes pump themselves faster than a human could ever physically manage to stop you from sliding on ice, how do they actually know what to do?
Yeah, that's the
I
thing.
mean, we're talking about literal chunks of metal and plastic reacting in milliseconds.
Well, people tend to look at the finished product and just treat it like magic. I mean, we're so surrounded by it every single day that we just sort of accept this intelligence baked into completely mundane objects without ever questioning the mechanics, you know? Like, how does a physical piece of plastic suddenly possess a brain?
Right. And it definitely isn't magic. It is a very specific, incredibly demanding field of engineering. And that is basically the mission of our deep dive today.
Absolutely.
We're pulling back the curtain to uncover the invisible backbone of our entire modern automated world. We're looking at embedded systems engineering.
It is the absolute definition of a hidden in plain sight industry. I mean, as every physical object in our lives becomes smart, from, connected refrigerators to autonomous delivery drones, this particular branch of engineering is what actually bridges that physical reality of electricity and metal with the digital realm of code.
And to help us navigate that bridge, we're pulling our insights from a really comprehensive 2026 career and technology guide. It was published by Embedded Hash, which is this major industry training
Yeah,
provider.
that's a great source.
It really is. They've mapped out the whole landscape,
Yeah.
what it is, how it works, the huge global talent shift happening right now, and the absolute bleeding edge of where it's all going. Okay, let's unpack this because the very first hurdle is just untangling the terminology.
Oh, for sure. The terminology trips everyone up.
Right, because there's a massive difference between an embedded system as a product and embedded systems engineering as a discipline.
Yeah, let's start with the product part. So, an embedded system is the physical thing itself. It's that little green circuit board driven by a microcontroller sitting quietly inside your microwave right now, just waiting for you to press the popcorn button.
The little green board you only see if you accidentally smash the microwave.
Exactly. That board, that isolated brain. Embedded systems engineering, on the other hand, is the entire grueling discipline required to bring that board into existence in the first place.
Which means we're not just talking about someone sitting down and writing a few lines of code.
Not at all. Not even close. It encompasses, well, the hardware design, the firmware development, software integration, the rigorous physical testing.
Because it has to actually exist in the physical world.
Right. And then the final deployment into the field, it is the act of designing a dedicated computing system built into a larger mechanical device to perform a very, very specific function.
And that narrow focus. That's what makes it so fundamentally different from like the software you and I interact with every day. Because when I think of a computer, I picture my laptop.
Sure, or a smartphone.
Yeah, general purpose machines.
Yeah.
I can open a web browser, play a crazy, graphically intense game, write a script all at the exact same time. But an embedded system is built to do one job or maybe a tiny set of related jobs with just absolute perfection.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that singular focus is basically dictated by massive physical constraints.
Right.
When software developers build a mobile app, they have gigabytes of RAM to play with. They have massive lithium-ion batteries, incredibly fast multi-core processors, but embedded engineers operate in a totally different reality.
They're boxed in.
Completely boxed in. They battle severe limitations every single day. We're talking heavily restricted memory space, incredibly strict power consumption limits, and the absolute unforgiving demand for real-time responses.
And on top of those digital constraints, they have actual physical environmental constraints,
Yeah.
right? Because an app on my phone doesn't have to worry about surviving a blizzard in Minnesota.
No, it just sits in your pocket.
Right. But the physical hardware of an embedded system might be baking inside the engine bay of a semi-truck in a Texas summer. It has to endure the real world.
Yeah, the core objectives of this discipline are reliability, energy efficiency, and long-term stability. Because think about it, a poorly optimized piece of code on a consumer smart device, it could drain its battery in a matter of hours, rendering it totally useless.
Which is annoying, but fine.
Right, but now scale that up to a safety-critical application. Like, think about a medical device. If the embedded system in an insulin pump or a cardiac pacemaker fails, or even just lags for a fraction of a second to process a command, the consequences are immediately life-threatening.
Wow, yeah. It kind of makes me think, so software engineers who build web apps are essentially the architects of digital skyscrapers. It's impressive, it's sprawling, there are a million moving parts. But if the skyscraper's digital elevator glitches, you just refresh the browser page.
Exactly, no harm done.
Right, it's an annoyance. But embedded engineers are designing the pacemaker. If the skyscraper glitches, you're annoyed. If the pacemaker glitches, it is a catastrophic disaster.
That's a great way to put it.
They're building the ultimate full stack of the physical world.
Full stack of the physical world, yeah. That captures the sheer breadth of the required knowledge perfectly. They cannot afford to just understand the code, and they can't just understand how to solder wires.
They need both.
They need an intimate relationship between the software and the physical circuitry, because a brilliantly written algorithm is entirely useless if the physical circuit board it runs on suffers from, like, electrical interference from a nearby motor.
Okay, so how does a team actually build one of these physical brains from scratch? Because we need to look at the engineering life cycle here. The sheer amount of specialized tooling involved is wild. The guide says it always starts with the physical hardware design.
Yeah, before anyone even touches a keyboard to write code, the physical landscape has to be mapped out. Engineers select the specific microcontroller, which is essentially a tiny, self-contained computer on a single chip.
Okay.
Then they use these really complex computer-aided design tools, things like Altium Designer, Eagle, or KiCad, to actually draw up the schematics for the printed circuit boards, the PCBs.
Just to visualize that for you listening, using a program like Altium isn't like, you know, drawing a picture in MS Paint. Mm-hmm. It's more like designing a microscopic city map, right?
Yes.
Where the roads are tiny copper traces that carry electrical current, and the buildings are the microchips and the sensors.
That is a highly accurate visualization. They are meticulously routing those copper traces to connect sensors which detect environmental changes like temperature or motion back to that central chip.
Like a central nervous system.
Exactly. And they are wiring up actuators, which are the physical components that take an electrical signal and turn it into actual movement. You know, like opening a physical valve or spinning a motor.
Okay. So once that microscopic city is built and manufactured, you have to wake it up. You have to give it instructions. Which brings us to firmware development. Now, firmware is described as low-level code, which, I got to be honest, always sounds a bit derogatory to me.
Yeah, it sounds like an insult.
Right. But in this context, low-level just means it is operating as close to the physical metal as possible.
It is the foundational intelligence of the device. The firmware basically lives in the device's non-volatile memory.
Meaning memory that doesn't just get wiped clean the second you unplug the device. Like, it remembers who it is even without power.
Yes, exactly. The firmware directly controls the microcontroller's registers. And you can think of registers as tiny, lightning-fast scratch pads built directly into the processor where it does its most immediate math and calculations.
Oh, interesting.
And the firmware also controls the peripheral. Those are the external features, like the physical pins that connect out to the sensors. But once that core heartbeat is established, modern devices rarely just exist in isolation anymore. They need to connect to wider networks. So engineers integrate this firmware using a real-time operating system, an RTOS.
Okay, so how does a real-time operating system actually differ from something like Windows or macOS?
Well, a desktop operating system is designed for fairness.
Fairness.
Yeah, it tries to juggle your music player, your web browser, your word processor all at once so everything feels smooth to you, the user.
Okay, right.
An RTOS is designed for absolute deterministic priority. If the anti-lock brake system needs processing power, the RTOS will instantly pause every other secondary task to ensure that brake command happens in an exact guaranteed window of microseconds. There is no waiting in line.
Wow. That makes the testing phase sound utterly terrifying. I mean, you have the hardware, you have the firmware, you have this incredibly strict RTOS, and you have to prove it won't fail when someone steps on the brake pedal at 70 miles per hour on the highway.
Yeah, it's intense.
The guide mentions hardware-in-the-loop testing, or HIL testing, and my brain immediately pictures a microchip strapped to a tiny treadmill,
mm-hmm.
What's actually happening in a lab when they run an agile test?
So hardware-in-the-loop testing is essentially creating a complex virtual reality simulation, but for the physical circuit board.
Wait, really?
Yeah, because if you are building the controller for a car engine, you do not want to test early buggy code on a real explosive engine.
No, definitely not.
So engineers plug the physical circuit board into a massive testing computer, and that computer sends fake electrical signals to the board, essentially tricking it into thinking it is connected to a real engine running at 5,000 RPMs on a snowy road.
So it's literally the Matrix for microchips.
It really is.
Yeah. They are fooling the physical brain to see how it reacts to extreme stress, completely virtually, without putting human lives at risk.
Precisely. They observe how the board responds to those simulated inputs just to ensure it performs flawlessly under every conceivable edge case. And, you know, to pull all of this off, these components have to communicate constantly using specialized protocols. The industry uses this total alphabet soup of standards, UART, SPI, I2C, and crucially, the CAN protocol.
Yeah, the CAN protocol seems to be the absolute gold standard in the automotive industry. But what is a protocol actually doing physically inside the car?
Well, imagine if every single sensor, every button, every motor in a modern car needed a direct, dedicated copper wire running all the way back to the main computer.
It would be a massive knot of wire.
The car would weigh an extra 1,000 pounds just in copper wiring alone. So the CAN protocol, which stands for Controller Area Network, acts like a central nervous system, or almost like a shared chat room.
A chat room.
Yeah, all the different microcontrollers in the car are tapped into one main network cable. So when you press the brake pedal, the brake controller broadcasts a message to the network, and the wheels instantly read that specific message and react. It drastically reduces the wiring and massively increases reliability.
Okay, wait, I need to push back on something in the source material regarding the actual code running all this.
Right.
Because it states that for firmware development in 2026, engineers are still primarily relying on embedded C and C++ pay.
Right.
With the astronomical hype around Python over the last few years and all these modern super developer-friendly languages, why on earth is this cutting-edge industry still chained to C, a language created like decades ago?
What's fascinating here is that it all circles back to those massive physical constraints we talked about earlier. When you are writing code for a resource-starved chip like the ARM Cortex processors that really dominate the industry, you need a language that compiles down to incredibly tight, highly efficient machine code. You need surgical control over exactly how memory is allocated.
And Python just can't do that.
Python is a high-level language. It is incredibly user-friendly, specifically because it does a lot of the background memory management for you.
Oh, I see.
But that convenience comes with a huge processing overhead. It requires an interpreter to run, which eats up precious memory and processing cycles. You absolutely do not want the split-second decision of a vehicle's airbag deployment to be delayed because a high-level programming language was busy, you know, managing its own memory garbage collection.
Right. Hold on. I'm cleaning up my files. I'll deploy the airbag in a second.
Exactly. C gives the engineer direct, unadulterated access to the hardware. Now, Python is certainly expanding its footprint in the embedded space, but it is primarily utilized for writing automation scripts, rapid prototyping, and building those complex testing environments we talked about, not the core real-time firmware itself.
So it's speed and efficiency over developer convenience. That makes total sense. And, you know, because you were asking engineers to write perfect, hyper-efficient C code that also interfaces directly with raw physical voltage, finding people who possess both those skill sets is incredibly difficult.
It's a huge challenge.
Which perfectly explains the massive geographic shift happening in this industry right now.
Yeah, the talent bottleneck is very real. And the source makes it abundantly clear that India has rapidly evolved into the primary global hub for embedded systems development here in 2026.
And this isn't just organic growth, right? It is highly engineered state policy. The documentation points to massive government initiatives, specifically things like the Make in India campaign and the Production Linked Incentive or PLI scheme, specifically for semiconductors.
The PLI scheme is crucial to understand. It is essentially the government offering massive financial subsidies and incentives to global tech companies, but only if they physically manufacture and design their hardware within the country.
Oh, wow.
It's a very strategic move to build domestic capability in chip design and electronics manufacturing.
And the gravity of those incentives is pulling in the biggest players on the planet. I mean, global tech behemoths, Qualcomm, Bosch, Texas Instruments, Intel, NVIDIA, they aren't just opening up little sales offices. They are establishing massive primary research and development centers in cities like Bengaluru, Hyderabad, and Pune.
They are actively hunting for the specific breed of engineer.
And that aggressive hiring creates a fascinating talent market. Because if we look at the salary data provided for 2026, it paints a picture of a highly lucrative specialization. Like for a fresher, which is the term used for an entry-level grad with 0 to 2 years of experience, the starting range is around 3.5 to 6 lakhs per annum.
Right.
And for our global listeners, lakhs refers to hundreds of thousands of rupees. So while that entry-level range translates to a relatively modest starting point in Western currencies in the context of the local market, it is a very solid foothold. But the escalation is what really caught my eye.
The growth potential is huge.
Yeah. As an engineer climbs to a lead or architect role with over 10 years of experience, the compensation just skyrockets to 22 to well over 40 lakhs per annum. That is a massive premium for localized expertise.
It really reflects the sheer scarcity of true cross-domain knowledge. The source actually clarifies this by contrasting the embedded systems engineer with adjacent roles.
Okay, like what?
Well, if you look at a pure electronics engineer, their world is strictly focused on component-level circuit design.
So just the hardware?
Right. They are dealing with analog and digital signal processing, resistor values, power routing. On the other end of the spectrum, an IoT, or Internet of Things engineer, is heavily focused on the cloud architecture. They figure out how to take data from a smart device and securely route it to an Amazon Web Services server for data analytics.
So what does this all mean? It basically means the embedded systems engineer is the translator standing squarely in the middle. They possess the deep hardware comprehension of the electronics engineer, combined with the low-level programming mastery to actually force that hardware to execute logic. They're basically bilingual.
They are bilingual. And bridging that gap requires intense practical training. You cannot learn how to debug a timing error between a physical sensor and a software algorithm simply by reading a textbook. The guide highlights institutes like Embedded Hash, based in JNTU, Hyderabad, specifically because they enforce project-based learning.
Yeah, they are making students build physical robotic arms, design smart home automation systems, and code IoT weather stations entirely from scratch.
Hands-on's the only way.
They're forcing them to use oscilloscopes, which are those monitors that actually let you see the physical wave of electricity moving through a wire, and logic analyzers to physically hunt down bugs.
That tactile experience is non-negotiable. When a prototype fails in the real world, the engineer has to figure out if the problem is a bug in their C code or if a microscopic capacitor on the board is just failing to hold a charge. Mm. Only hands-on experience teaches you how to diagnose across both of those domains.
Wow. So what does this all mean for the trajectory of a career in this space? To me, the modern embedded engineer has achieved the ultimate form of career resilience because they fluently speak both the language of pure physical voltage and the language of software logic. They have unrestricted access to multiple industries.
The dual industry access is a massive advantage. An embedded systems professional can fluidly migrate between core traditional manufacturing, like heavy automotive, aerospace, or industrial robotics, and the pure IT and consumer electronics sectors.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. If the global automotive market experiences a massive downturn, that exact same engineer can immediately pivot to designing the firmware for next-generation medical wearables or smart home infrastructure.
Okay, so with tens of thousands of these highly trained bilingual engineers pouring into the market, heavily concentrated in R&D hubs like Hyderabad and Bengaluru, what exactly are they building next? The guide outlines the 2026 horizon, and the shift in how devices think is wild.
The overarching technological trend of 2026 is pushing intelligence as close to the physical source as possible. And the absolute prime example of this is the explosion of Tiny ML.
Tiny machine learning. Literally bringing AI out of the cloud and shrinking it down.
Historically, if a piece of hardware needed to run a complex artificial intelligence model, say a smart camera trying to recognize a specific face, it couldn't do the math itself.
Right, the chip was too weak.
It had to capture the image, send the data over the internet to a massive cloud server farm somewhere, wait for a warehouse full of computers to process the algorithm, and then wait for the answer to be sent back down. Tiny ML is the engineering art of stripping down those massive machine learning models, mathematically optimizing them so they are small enough to run natively on a tiny microcontroller with just kilobytes of memory.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. So instead of my smart home security camera sensing motion, uploading a video to a server in another country to figure out if it's a burglar or it's just a stray cat and waiting for a response. TinyML means the camera itself has its own localized, optimized brain. It makes that complex pattern recognition decision in a split second, entirely on its own, without ever needing an internet connection.
You've nailed the concept. It is a critical component of what the industry calls edge computing.
Edge computing.
Processing the data locally at the edge of the network drastically reduces latency, which is the delay caused by data traveling over networks. It conserves massive amounts of bandwidth because devices aren't constantly streaming raw data to the cloud. And crucially, it ensures the device remains fully functional even if the internet goes down completely.
And that concept of localized intelligence is bleeding into everything. The Source explores Industry 4.0 and the integration of 5G connectivity. Like, we are looking at smart factories where embedded sensors on the assembly line analyze their own vibrational data in real time.
Yeah, they don't wait for a central server.
They aren't just reporting that a machine is broken. They are using predictive maintenance to alert human operators that a specific gear will likely fracture in 3 days based on micro vibrations.
And then you have autonomous vehicles, which represent the ultimate high-stakes proving ground for embedded systems today.
Oh, definitely.
The sheer volume of raw data being processed by Advanced Driver Assistance Systems, ADS, is staggering. A modern autonomous vehicle is covered in radar modules, LiDAR spinners, high-definition cameras. All of those separate sensory inputs are feeding massive amounts of data into embedded controllers simultaneously.
And it has to make sense of all of it instantly.
Right. Those controllers have to perform sensor fusion, stitching all that diverse data together into a single, cohesive map of the world, and make life or death steering and braking decisions in real time.
The engineering required to make that reliable is incredible.
Yeah.
But looking at billions of these localized brains being placed into our cars, our medical devices, and our infrastructure, it sounds like a security nightmare waiting to happen.
This raises an important question, and the guide flags it as the defining challenge of 2026. The cybersecurity paradigm is entirely different here. 20 years ago, if a malicious actor wanted to disable a factory, they had to physically break through a fence and smash a machine with a hammer.
Right.
But as we connect localized digital brains to physical actuators, the attack surface changes completely. Securing these physical endpoints against cyber threats is no longer just an IT problem. It is a physical safety problem.
Because the stakes aren't just, you know, a stolen credit card number or a defaced website. The stakes are physical control over the kinetic world around us.
If a hacker manages to breach a smart factory's programmable logic controllers, the embedded brains running the robotic arms, they can literally rewrite the firmware to intentionally swing a robotic arm into a wall, causing devastating physical damage.
Oh my God.
Securing an embedded system requires a deeply integrated approach. You have to secure the physical ports on the board so someone can't just plug in a USB drive. You have to encrypt the communication protocols like the CAN bus. And you have to ensure the firmware itself cannot be overwritten by unauthorized code.
It really is a landscape of extremes. It is incredibly demanding, highly technical, and fundamentally vital to how modern society operates. So, you know, the next time you are driving in the rain and you feel those anti-lock brakes rhythmically pulsing under your foot to keep you safe, or you simply hear that cheerful little chime from your washing machine letting you know the cycle is complete, take a moment to appreciate what is actually happening. You are experiencing the invisible, highly optimized art of hardware-software integration.
Whether you are an aspiring engineer eyeing the massive talent boom in hubs like Hyderabad as a potential career path, or you are just an everyday consumer trying to comprehend the intelligence of the smart tech filling your home, understanding this specialized field is the key to understanding reality today. It is the foundation that our automated world is built upon.
It truly is the invisible backbone. But before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final lingering thought to mull over. Something that wasn't explicitly debated in the source material, but it really builds on everything we've uncovered. The guide emphasized that the holy grail of embedded systems is long-term stability. The goal is for these microcontrollers to operate for years, sometimes decades, buried deep inside a machine without a single reboot or update.
Right, set it and forget it.
But we live in an era where technology, programming languages, and engineering paradigms are evolving at breakneck speed. Think about 30 or 40 years from now. What happens when critical global infrastructure, our bridges equipped with structural health monitors, our automated power grids, our deep space satellites, is still running flawlessly on highly specialized, heavily optimized C code written in 2026?
Mm.
What happens when the original engineers, who intricately understood that specific low-level firmware, have all retired or passed away? As the physical world becomes permanently fused with immutable code, how will the next generation maintain the invisible brains they didn't build?